No one can take Mother away from us. Gauta came over and touched his little brother. Don't cry. They can't do anything to her. You must get hold of yourself, Munan. Rest assured that we will protect our mother, my boy. Kristen sat holding the child tightly in her arms. She felt as if he had saved her with his tears. Then Lavran spoke, sitting up in bed with the flush of fever on his cheeks.
Well, what are you going to do, brothers?
When the mass is over, said Nokva, we'll go over to the parsonage and offer to pay a guarantee for our foster father. That's the first thing we'll do. Do you agree, my lads?
Bjørgulf, Gauta, Ivar, and Skúla assented. Kristen said, Ulf raised a weapon against a man in the cemetery, and I must do something to clear both his name and mine from these rumors. These are such serious matters, boys, that I think you young men must seek someone else's counsel to decide what should be done.
Who should we ask for advice? Said Nokva, a little scornfully.
Sir Sigurd of Sundbu is my cousin, replied his mother hesitantly.
Since that has never occurred to him before, said the young man in the same tone of voice, I don't think it fitting for the sons of Erland to go begging to him now, when we're in need. What do you say, brothers? Even if we're not legally of age, we can still wield our weapons with skill, all five of us.
Boys, said Kristen, using weapons will get you nowhere in this matter.
You must let us decide that, Mother, replied Nokva curtly. But now, Mother, I think you should let us eat. And sit down in your usual place, for the servants' sake, he said, as if he could command her.
She could hardly eat a thing. She sat and pondered. She didn't dare ask whether they would now send word to their father. And she wondered how this case would be handled. She knew little of the law in such matters. No doubt she would have to refute the rumors by swearing an oath along with either 5 or 11 others. If so, it would probably take place at the Church of Ulysin in Volga. She had kinsmen there on nearly every large estate from her mother's lineage. If her oath failed, and she had to stand before their eyes without being able to clear herself of this shameful charge, it would bring shame upon her father. He had been an outsider here in the valley, but he had known how to assert himself. Everyone had respected him. Whenever Lavrans Björgulfsson took up a matter at a ting or a meeting, he had always won full support. Still, she knew it was on him that her shame would fall. She suddenly realized how alone her father had stood. In spite of everything, he was alone and a stranger among the people here every time she heaped upon him one more burden of sorrow and shame and disgrace. She didn't think she could ever feel this way anymore. Again and again she had thought her heart would burst into bloody pieces, and now, once again, it felt as if it would break. Gauta went out to the gallery and looked north.
People are leaving the church, he said. Shall we wait until they've gone some distance away?
No, said Nokva. Let them see that the sons of Erland are coming.
We should get ready now, lads. We had better wear our steel helmets.
Only Nokva owned proper armor. He left the coat of mail behind, but he put on his helmet and picked up his shield, his sword, and a long lance. Bjørgulf and Gauta put on the old iron hats that boys wore when they practiced sword fighting, while Ivar and Skúla had to be content with the small steel caps that peasant soldiers still wore. Their mother looked at them. She had such a shattered feeling in her breast. It seems to me ill-advised, my sons, for you to arm yourselves in this fashion to go over to the parsonage, she said uneasily. You shouldn't forget about the peace of the Sabbath and the presence of the bishop.
Nokva replied, Honor has grown scarce here at Durengard, Mother. We have to pay dearly for whatever we can get.
Not you, Bjørgulf, pleaded their mother fearfully, for the weak-sided boy had picked up a big battle axe. Remember that you can't see well, son.
Oh, I can see as far as I need to, said Bjørgulf, weighing the axe in his hand. Gauta went over to young Lavran's bed and took down their grandfather's great sword, which the boy always insisted on keeping on the wall above his bed. He drew the blade from its scabbard and looked at it.
You must lend me your sword, kinsman. I think our grandfather would be pleased if we took it along on this venture.
Kristen wrung her hands as she sat there. She felt as if she would scream, with terror and the utmost dread, but also with a power that was stronger than either her torment or her fear, the way she had screamed when she gave birth to these men. Wound after countless wound she had endured in this life, but now she knew that they all had healed. The scars were as tender as raw flesh, but she knew that she would not bleed to death. Never had she felt more alive than she did now. Blossoms and leaves had been stripped away from her, but she had not been cut down, nor had she fallen. For the first time since she had given birth to the children of Erland Nikolausen, she completely forgot about the father and saw only her sons. But the sons did not look at their mother, who sat there, pale, with strained and frightened eyes. Munon was still on her lap. He hadn't let go of her even for a moment. The five boys left the loft. Kristen stood up and stepped out onto the gallery. They emerged from behind the buildings and walked swiftly along the path toward Romengard, between the pale, swaying acres of barley. Their steel caps and iron hats gleamed dully, but the sun glittered on Nokva's lance and on the spear points of the twins. She stood staring after the five young men. She was mother to them all. Back inside, she collapsed before the chest over which the picture of Mary hung. Sobs tore her apart. Munon began to cry too, and weeping, he crept close to his mother. Lavrans leaped out of bed and threw himself to his knees on the other side of her. She put her arms around both her youngest sons. Ever since the infant had died, she had wondered why she should pray. Hard, cold, and heavy as stone, she had felt as if she were falling into the gaping maw of hell. Now the prayers burst from her lips of their own volition, without any conscious will. Her soul streamed toward Mary, maiden and mother, the queen of heaven and earth, with cries of anguish and gratitude and praise. Mary, Mary, I have so much. I still have endless treasures that can be plundered from me. Merciful mother, take them into your protection. There were many people in the courtyard of Romengard. When the sons of Erland arrived, several farmers asked them what they wanted.
We want nothing from you, yet,
said Nokva, smiling slyly.
We have business with the bishop today, Magnus. Later my brothers and I may decide that we want to have a few words with the rest of you too. But today you have no need to fear us.
There was a great deal of shouting and commotion. Sira Solmund came out and tried to forbid the boys to stay. But then several farmers took up their cause and said they should be allowed to make inquiries about this charge against their mother. The bishop's men came out and told the sons of Erland they would have to leave because food was being served and no one had time to listen to them. But the farmers were not pleased by this.
What is it, good folks?
Thundered a voice overhead. No one had noticed that Lord Hallvard himself had come out into the loft gallery. Now he was standing there in his violet robes, with the red silk cap on his white hair, tall and stout and looking like a chieftain.
Who are these young men?
He was told that they were Kristen's sons from Urengard.
Are you the oldest?
The bishop asked Nokva.
Then I will talk to you. But the others must wait here in the courtyard in the meantime.
Nokva climbed the steps to the high loft and followed the bishop into the room. Lord Hallvard sat down in the high seat and looked at the young man standing before him, leaning on his lance.
What is your name?
Nikolaus Erlandsen, my lord.
Do you think you need to be so well armed, Nikolaus Erlandsen, in order to speak to your bishop?
Asked the other man with a little smile. Nikolaus blushed bright red. He went over to the corner, put down his weapons and cape, and came back. He stood before the bishop, bareheaded, his face lowered, with one hand clasping the wrist of the other, his bearing easy and free, but seemly and respectful. Lord Hallvard thought that this young man had been taught courtly and noble manners, and he couldn't have been a child when his father lost his riches and honorable position. He must certainly remember the time when he was considered the heir of Huseby. He was a handsome lad as well. The bishop felt great compassion for him.
Were those your brothers? All those young men who were with you? How many of you are there, you sons of Erlon?
There are seven of us still living, my lord.
So many young lives involved in this.
The bishop gave an involuntary sigh.
Sit down, Nicholas. I suppose you want to talk to me about these rumors that have come forth about your mother and her overseer.
Thank you, Your Grace. But I would prefer to stand.
The bishop looked thoughtfully at the youth. Then he said slowly,
I must tell you, Nicholas, that I find it difficult to believe that what has been said about Kristen Lavran's daughter is true. And no one other than her husband has the right to accuse her of adultery. But then there is the matter of the kinship between your father and this man Ulf, and the fact that he is your godfather. Jotrud has presented her complaint in such a manner that there is much to indicate a lack of honor on your mother's part. Do you know whether it's true what she says, that the man often struck her, and that he has shunned her bed for almost a year?
Ulf and Jotrud did not live well together. Our foster father was no longer young when he married, and he can be rather stubborn and hot-tempered. Toward myself and my brothers, and toward our father and mother, he has always been the most loyal kinsman and friend. That is the first request I intended to make of you, kind sir. If it is at all possible, that you would release Ulf as a free man against payment of a guarantee.
You are not yet of lawful age, asked the bishop.
No, my lord. But our mother is willing to pay whatever guarantee you might demand.
The bishop shook his head.
But my father will do the same. I'm certain of that. It's my intention to ride straight from here to see him, to tell him what has happened. If you would grant him an audience tomorrow.
The bishop rested his chin on his hand and sat there stroking his beard with his thumb, making a faint scraping sound.
Sit down, Nicholas, he said, and we'll be able to talk better.
Nokva bowed politely and sat down.
So then it's true that Ulf has refused to live with his wife? He continued as if he just happened to remember it.
Yes, my lord. As far as I know.
The bishop couldn't help smiling. And then the young man smiled a little too.
Ulf has been sleeping in the loft with all of us brothers since Christmas.
The bishop sat in silence for a moment.
What about food? Where does he eat?
He had his wife pack provisions for him whenever he went into the woods or left the estate.
Nokva's expression grew a little uncertain.
There were some quarrels about that. Mother thought it best for him to take his meals with us, as he did before he was married. Ulf didn't want to do that because he said people would talk if he changed the terms of the agreement which he and father made when he set up his own household, about the goods that he would be given from the estate. And he didn't think it was right for mother to provide food for him again without some deductions in what he had been granted. But it was arranged as mother wanted, and Ulf began taking his meals with us again. The other part was to be figured out later.
Otherwise, your mother has a reputation for keeping a close eye on her property, and she is an exceedingly enterprising and frugal woman.
Not with food, said Nokva eagerly. Anyone will tell you that. Any man or woman who has ever served on our estate. Mother is the most generous of women when it comes to food. In that regard, she's no different now from when we were rich. She's never happier than when she can set some special dish on the table. And she makes such an abundance that every servant, right down to the goatherd and the beggar, receives his share of the good food.
The bishop sat lost in thought.
You mentioned that you wanted to seek out your father.
Yes, my lord. Surely that must be the reasonable thing to do?
When the bishop didn't reply, he continued.
We spoke to father this winter, my brother Gauta and I. We also told him that mother was with child. But we saw no sign, nor did we hear a single word from his lips that might indicate he had doubts that mother had not been as faithful as gold to him, or that he was surprised. But father has never felt at ease in Sil. He wanted to live on his own farm in Dovre, and mother was up there for a while this summer. He was angry because she refused to stay and keep house for him. He wanted her to let Gauta and me manage Urengard while she moved to Haugen.
Bishop Hallvard kept rubbing his beard as he studied the young man. No matter what sort of man Erland Nikolausen might be, surely he wouldn't have been contemptible enough to accuse his wife of adultery before their young sons. In spite of everything that seemed to speak against Kristin Lavran's daughter, he just didn't believe it. He thought she was telling the truth when she denied knowledge of the suspicions about her and Ulf Haldorsson. And yet he remembered that this woman had been weak before, when desires of the flesh had beckoned. With loathsome deceit, she and this man with whom she now lived in discord had managed to win Lavran's consent. When the talk turned to the death of the child, he saw at once that her conscience troubled her. But even if she had neglected her child, she could not be brought before a court of law for that reason. She would have to repent before God in accordance with the strictures of her confessor. And the child might still be her husband's even if she had cared for it poorly. She couldn't possibly be glad to be burdened with another infant, now that she was no longer young and had been abandoned by her husband, with 7 sons already, and in much more meager circumstances than was their birthright. It would be unreasonable to expect that she could have had much love for that child. He didn't think she was an unfaithful wife, although only God knew what he had heard and experienced in the 40 years he had been a priest and listened to confessions. But he believed her. And yet there was only one way in which he could interpret Erland Nikolausen's behavior in this matter. He had refused to seek out his wife when she was with child, or after the birth, or when the infant died. He must have thought that he was not the father. What now remained to find out was how the man would act. Whether he would stand up and defend his wife all the same, for the sake of his 7 sons, as an honorable man would do, or whether, now that these rumors were being openly discussed, he would bring charges against her. Based on what the bishop had heard about Erland of Husaby, he wasn't sure he could count on the man not to do this.
"Who are your mother's closest kinsmen?" he asked.
"Jamalt Halvardsson of Alin is married to her sister, the widow of Simon Dara of Formo. She also has 2 cousins, Ketil Osmundsson of Skog and his sister Rana, who is married to Sigurd Schierning. Ivar Yesling of Ringheim and his brother, Havard Tronsson, are the sons of her mother's brother. But all of them live far away."
"What about Sir Sigurd Eljarn of Sundbu? He and your mother are cousins. In a case like this, the knight must step forward to defend his kinswoman, Nikolaus. You must seek him out this very day and tell him about this, my friend."
Nokva replied reluctantly,
"Honorable lord, there has been little kinship between him and us. And I don't think, my lord, that it would benefit mother's case if this man came to her defense. Erland Eljarn's lineage is not well liked here in the villages. Nothing harmed my father more in the eyes of the people than the fact that the Yeslings had joined him in the plot that cost us Husaby, while they lost Sundbu."
"Yes, Erland Eljarn."
The bishop laughed a little.
"Yes, he had a talent for disagreeing with people. He quarreled with all his kinsmen up here in the north. Your maternal grandfather, who was a pious man and not afraid to give in if it meant strengthening the peace and harmony among kin, even he couldn't manage any better. He and Erland Eljarn were the bitterest of foes."
"Yes," Nokva couldn't help chuckling. "And it wasn't over anything important either. 2 embroidered sheets and a blue-hemmed towel. Altogether, they weren't worth more than 2 marks. But my grandmother had impressed upon her husband that he must make sure to acquire these things when her father's estate was settled.
and Gudrun Ivar's daughter had also spoken of them to her own husband. Erland Eljarn finally seized them and hid them away in his traveling bag, but Lavrans took them out again. He felt he had the most right to these things, for it was Ranfrid who had made them as a young maiden, while she was living at home at Sundbu. When Erland became aware of this, he struck my grandfather in the face, and then grandfather threw him to the floor 3 times and shook him like a pelt. After that, they never spoke again, and it was all because of those scraps of fabric. Mother has them at home in her chest. The bishop laughed heartily. He knew this story well, which had amused everyone greatly when it occurred, that the husbands of the daughters of Ivar should be so eager to please their wives. But he had achieved what he intended. The features of the young man's face had thawed into a smile, and the wary, anguished expression had been driven from his handsome blue-gray eyes for a moment. Then Lord Hallvard laughed even louder. Oh, yes, Nikolaus. They did speak to each other one more time, and I was present. I was in Oslo, at the Christmas banquet, the year before Queen Euphemia died. My blessed Lord King Håkon was talking to Lavrans. He had come south to bring his greetings to his lord and to pledge his loyal service. The king told him that this enmity between the husbands of two sisters was unchristian and the behavior of petty men. Lavrans went over to where Erland Eljarn was standing with several other royal retainers and asked him in a friendly manner to forgive him for losing his temper. He said he would send the things to Fru Gudrun with loving greetings from her brother and sister. Erland replied that he would agree to reconcile if Lavrans would accept the blame before the men standing there and admit that he had acted like a thief and a robber with regard to the inheritance of their father-in-law. Lavrans turned on his heel and walked away, and that, I believe, was the last time Ivar Yesling's sons-in-law ever met on this earth, concluded the bishop, laughing loudly. But listen to me, Nikolaus Erlandsen, he said, placing the palms of his hands together. I don't know whether it would be wise to make such haste to bring your father here or to set this Ulf Haldursson free. It seems to me that your mother must clear her name, since there has been so much talk that she has sinned. But as matters now stand, do you think it would be easy for Kristin to find the women willing to swear the oath along with her? Nikolaus looked up at the bishop. His eyes grew uncertain and fearful. But wait a few days, Nikolaus. Your father and Ulf are strangers in the region and not well-liked. Kristin and Jartrud both are from here in the valley, but Jartrud is from much farther south, while your mother is one of their own. And I've noticed that Lavrans Bjørgulfsson has not been forgotten by the people. It looks as if they mostly had intended to chastise her because she seemed to them a bad daughter. And yet already I can see that many realize the father would be poorly served by raising such an outcry against his child. They are remorseful and repentant, and soon there will be nothing they wish for more than that Kristin should be able to clear her name. And perhaps Jartrud will have scant evidence to present when she has a look inside her bag. But it's another matter if her husband goes around turning people against him. My lord, said Nokva, looking up at the bishop, forgive me for saying this, but I find this difficult to accept, that we should do nothing for our foster father, and that we should not bring our father to stand at mother's side. Nevertheless, my son, said Bishop Hallvard, I beg you to take my advice. Let us not hasten to summon Erland Nikolausen here. But I will write a letter to Sir Sigurd of Sundbu, asking him to come see me at once. What's that? He stood up and went out on the gallery. Against the wall of the building stood Gaute and Bjørgulf Erlandsen, and several of the bishop's men were threatening them with weapons. Bjørgulf struck a man to the ground with a blow of his axe as the bishop and Nokva came outside. Gaute defended himself with his sword. Some farmers seized hold of Ivar and Skula, while others led away the wounded man. Sira Solmund stood off to the side, bleeding from his mouth and nose. Halt! Shouted Lord Hallvard. Throw down your weapons, you sons of Erland! He went down to the courtyard and approached the young men, who obeyed at once.
What is the meaning of this?
Cirrus Solmoon stepped forward, bowed, and said,
I can tell you, Reverend Father, that Gauta Erlandsen has broken the peace of the Sabbath and struck me, his parish priest, as you can see.
Then a middle-aged farmer stepped forward, greeted the bishop, and said,
Reverend Father, the boy was sorely provoked. The priest spoke of his mother in such a way that it would be difficult to expect Gauta to listen peacefully.
Keep silent, priest. I cannot listen to more than one of you at a time, said Lord Hallvard impatiently.
Speak, Olav Tronson.
Olav Tronson said, The priest tried to rankle the sons of Erlon, but Bjørgulf and Gauta countered his words, calmly enough.
Gauta also said what we all know is true, that Kristin was with her husband at Dovre for a time this past summer, and that's when he was conceived, the poor infant who has stirred up all this trouble. But then the priest said the people of Urengard have always had so much book learning. No doubt she knew the story of King David and Bathsheba, but Erlan Nikolausen might have been just as cunning as Uriah the knight.
The bishop's face turned as purple as his robes. His black eyes flashed. He looked at Cirrus Solmoon for a moment, but he did not speak to him.
Surely you must know, Gauta Erlandsen, that with this deed you have brought the ban of the church upon your head, he said.
Then he ordered the sons of Erlan to be escorted home to Urengard. He sent along two of his men and four farmers, whom the bishop selected from among the most honorable and sensible, to keep guard over them.
You must go with him as well, Nikolaus, he told Nokva. But stay calm. Your brothers have not helped your mother, but I realize they were sorely vexed.
In his heart, the bishop of Hamar didn't think that Kristin's sons had harmed her case. He saw that there were already many who held a different opinion of the mistress of Urengard than they had in the morning, when she caused the goblet to overflow by coming to church with Ulf Haldorsson so that he might be godfather to her son. One of them was Kolbein Jonsson, so Lord Hallvard put him in charge of the guards. Nokva was the first to enter the high loft where Kristin was sitting on the bed with Lavrans, holding Munon on her lap. He told her what had happened, but put great weight on the fact that the bishop considered her innocent, and also thought the younger brothers had been greatly provoked to react as violently as they had. He counseled his mother not to seek out the bishop herself. Then the four brothers were escorted into the room. Their mother stared at them. She was pale, with an odd look in her eye. In the midst of her deep despair and anguish, she felt again the strange swelling of her heart, as if it might burst. And yet she said calmly to Gauta, Ill-advised was your behavior, son, and you brought little honor to the sword of Lavrans Bjørgulfsson by drawing it against a crowd of farmers who stood there gnawing on rumors.
First I drew it against the bishop's armed men, said Gauta indignantly. But it's true it did little honor to our grandfather that we had to bear arms against anyone for such a reason.
Kristin looked at her son. Then she had to turn away. As much as his words pained her, she had to smile too. Like when a child bites his mother's nipple with his first teeth, she thought.
Mother, said Nokva, now I think it best if you go. And take Munon with you. You mustn't leave him alone even for a moment until he is calmer. He said quietly. Keep him indoors so he doesn't see that his brothers are under guard.
Kristin stood up. My sons, if you don't think me undeserving, then I would ask that you kiss me before I leave. Nokva, Bjørgulf, Ivar, and Skula went over and kissed her. The one who had been banned gave his mother a sorrowful look. When she held out her hand to him, he took a fold of her sleeve and kissed it. Kristin saw that all of them, except for Gauta, were now taller than she was. She straightened up Lavran's bed a bit, and then she left with Munon. There were four buildings with lofts at Urengard: the high loft house, the new storeroom, which had been the summer quarters during Kristin's childhood, before Lavran's built the large house, the old storeroom, and the salt shed, which also had a loft. That's where the serving women slept in the summer. Kristen went up to the loft above the new storeroom with Munan. The two of them had slept there ever since the death of the infant. She was pacing back and forth when Frida and Gunnhild brought the evening porridge. Kristen asked Frida to see to it that the guardsmen were given ale and food. The maid replied that she had already done so, at Nokva's bidding, but the men had said they would not accept anything from Kristen since they were at her manor for such a purpose. They had received food and drink from somewhere else.
Even so, you must have a keg of foreign ale brought to them.
Gunnhild, the younger maid, was red-eyed from weeping.
None of the house servants believes this of you, Kristen Lavrun's daughter. Surely you must know that. We always said that we knew it was a lie.
So you have heard this gossip before, said her mistress. It would have been better if you had mentioned it to me.
We didn't dare because of Ulf, said Frida.
And Gunnhild said as she wept,
He warned us to keep it from you. I often thought that I should mention it and beg you to be more wary. When you would sit and talk to Ulf until late into the night.
Ulf? So he has known about this? Asked Kristen softly.
Jartrud has accused him of it for a long time. That was apparently always the reason that he struck her. One evening during Christmas, about the time when you were growing heavy, we were sitting and drinking with them in the foreman's house. Solveig and Irvind were there too, along with several people from south in the parish. Suddenly Jartrud said that he was the one who had caused it. Ulf hit her with his belt so the buckle drew blood. Since then, Jartrud has gone around saying that Ulf did not deny it with a single word.
And ever since, people have been talking about this in the countryside? Asked the mistress.
Yes, but those of us who are your servants have always denied it,
said Gunnhild in tears. To calm Munan, Kristen had to lie down next to the boy and take him in her arms. But she did not undress, and she did not sleep that night. In the meantime, up in the high loft, young Lavrans had gotten out of bed and put on his clothes. Toward evening, when Nokva went downstairs to help tend to the livestock, the boy went out to the stable. He saddled the red gelding that belonged to Gauta. It was the best horse except for the stallion, which he didn't trust himself to ride. Several of the men standing guard on the estate came out and asked the boy where he was headed.
I didn't know that I was a prisoner too, replied young Lavrans. But I don't need to hide it from you. Surely you wouldn't refuse to allow me to ride to Sunbu, to bring back the knight to defend his kinswoman.
It will soon be dark, my boy, said Kolbein Jonsson. We can't let this child ride across Vaaga Gorge at night. We must speak to his mother.
No, don't do that, said Lavrans.
His lips quivered.
The purpose of my journey is such that I will trust in God and the Virgin Mary to keep watch over me, if my mother is without blame. And if not, then it makes little difference.
He broke off, for he was close to tears. The man stood in silence for a moment. Kolbein gazed at the handsome, fair-haired child.
Go on, then, and may God be with you, Lavrans Erlandsson,
he said, and was about to help the boy into the saddle. But Lavrans led the horse forward, so the men had to step aside. At the big boulder near the manor gate, he climbed up and then flung himself onto the back of Raud. Then he galloped westward, along the road to Vaaga. Chapter 8 Lavrans had ridden his horse into a lather by the time he reached the spot where he knew a path led up through the scree and steep cliffs that rise up everywhere on the north side of Silsa Valley. He knew he had to make it to the heights before dark. He didn't know these mountains between Vaaga, Seal, and Dovre, but the gelding had grazed here one summer, and he had carried Gauta to Haugen many times, although along different paths. Young Lavrans leaned forward and patted the neck of his horse.
You must find the way to Haugen, Raud, my son. You must carry me to father tonight, my horse.
As soon as he reached the crest of the mountains and was once again sitting in the saddle, darkness fell quickly. He rode through a marshy hollow, An endless progression of narrow ridges was silhouetted against the ever-darkening sky. There were groves of birches on the valley slopes, and their trunks shone white. Wet clusters of leaves constantly brushed against the horse's chest and the boy's face. Stones were dislodged by the animal's hooves and rolled down into the creek at the bottom of the incline. Raud found his way in the dark, up and down the hillsides, and the trickling of the creek sounded first close and then far away. Once some beast bayed into the mountain night, but Lavrans couldn't tell what it was. And the wind rushed and sang, first stronger, then fainter. The child held his spear along the neck of his horse, so that the tip pointed forward between the animal's ears. This was bear country, this valley here. He wondered when it would end. Very softly he began to hum into the darkness.
Kyrie eleison, Christe eleison, Kyrie eleison, Christe eleison.
Raud splashed through the shallow crossing of a mountain stream. The sky became even more star-strewn all around. The mountain peaks looked more distant against the blackness of the night, and the wind sang with a different tone in the vast space. The boy let the horse choose his own path as he hummed as much as he could remember of the hymn,
Jesus Redemptor Omnium, tu lumen et splendor patris,
interspersed with
Kyrie eleison.
Now he could see by the stars that they were riding almost due south, but he didn't dare do anything but trust the horse and let him lead. They were riding over rocky slopes with reindeer moss gleaming palely on the stones beneath them. Raud paused for a moment, panting and peering into the night. Lavran saw that the sky was growing lighter in the east. Clouds were billowing up, edged with silver underneath. His horse moved on, now headed directly toward the rising moon. It must be about an hour before midnight, as far as the boy could tell. When the moon slipped free of the crests off in the distance, new snow gleamed atop the domes and rounded summits, and drifting wisps of fog turned the passes and peaks white. Lavrans recognized where he was in the mountains. He was on the mossy plateau beneath the blue domes. Soon afterward, he found a path leading down into the valley. And 3 hours later, Raud limped into the courtyard of Haugen, which was white with moonlight. When Erland opened the door, the boy collapsed on the floor of the gallery in a deep faint. Sometime later, Lavrans woke up in bed, lying between filthy, rank-smelling fur covers. Light shone from a pine torch that had been stuck in a crack in the wall nearby. His father was standing over him, moistening his face with something. His father was only half-dressed, and the boy noticed in the flickering light that his hair was completely gray.
Mother, said young Lavrans, looking up.
Erlan turned away so his son wouldn't see his face.
Yes,
he said after a moment, almost inaudibly.
Is your mother? Has she? Is your mother ill?
You must come home at once, father, and save her. Now they're accusing her of the worst of things. They've taken Ulf and her and my brothers captive, father.
Erlan touched the boy's hot face and hands. His fever had flared up again.
What are you saying?
But Lavran sat up and gave a fairly coherent account of everything that had taken place back home the day before. His father listened in silence, but halfway through the boy's story, he began to finish getting dressed. He pulled on his boots and fastened his spurs. Then he went to get some milk and food and brought them over to the child.
But you can't stay here alone in this house, my son. I will take you over to Aschlau, north of here in Brecken, before I ride home.
Father?
Lavrans grabbed his arm.
No, I want to go home with you.
You're ill, little son,
said Erlan, and the boy couldn't recall ever hearing such a tender tone in his father's voice.
No, father, I want to go home with you, to mother. I want to go home to my mother.
Now he was weeping like a small child.
But Raud is limping, my boy.
Erlan took his son on his lap, but he could not console the child.
And you're so tired.
Finally, he said,
Well, well. Sultan can surely carry both of us.
After he had led out the stallion, put Raud inside and tended to the animal, he said,
You must make sure to remember that someone comes north to take care of your horse and my things.
Are you going to stay home now, father?
Asked Lavrans joyfully. Erland gazed straight ahead.
I don't know, but I have a feeling I won't be back here again.
Shouldn't you be better armed, father?
The boy asked, for aside from his sword, Erland had picked up only a small, lightweight axe and was now about to leave the house.
Aren't you even going to take your shield?
Erland looked at his shield. The ox hide was so scratched and torn that the red lion against the white field had almost disappeared. He put it back down and spread the covers over it again.
I'm armed well enough to drive a horde of farmers from my manor, he said.
He went outside, closed the door to the house, mounted his horse, and helped the boy climb up behind him. The sky was growing more and more overcast. By the time they had come partway down the slope, where the forest was quite dense, they were riding in darkness. Erlon noticed that his son was so tired that he could hardly hold on. Then he let Lavran sit in front of him, and he held the boy in his arms. The young, fair-haired head rested against his chest. Of all the children, Lavran's was most like his mother. Erland kissed the top of his head as he straightened the hood on the boy's cape.
Did your mother grieve greatly when the infant died this summer?
He asked once, quite softly. Young Lavrans replied,
She didn't cry after he died, but she has gone up to the cemetery gate every night since. Gauta and Nokfa usually follow her when she leaves, but they haven't dared speak to her, and they don't dare let mother see that they've been keeping watch over her.
A little later, Erlon said,
She didn't cry? I remember back when your mother was young, and she wept as readily as the dew drips from goat willow reeds along the creek. She was so gentle and tender, Kristen, whenever she was with people whom she knew wished her well. Later on, she had to learn to be harder, and most often I was the one to blame.
Gunhild and Frida say that in all the days our youngest brother lived,
continued Lavrans.
She cried every minute when she thought no one would see her.
May God help me, said Erland in a low voice. I've been a foolish man.
They rode through the valley floor, with the curve of the river at their backs. Erland wrapped his cape around the boy as best he could. Lavrans dozed and kept threatening to fall asleep. He sensed that his father's body smelled like that of a poor man. He had a vague memory from his early childhood, while they were living at Husaby, when his father would come from the bathhouse on Saturdays, and he would have several little balls in his hands. They smelled so good, and the delicate, sweet scent would cling to his palms and to his clothing during the whole Sabbath. Erland rode steadily and briskly. Down on the moors it was pitch dark. Without thinking about it, he knew at every moment where he was. He recognized the changing sound of the river's clamor as the log rushed through rapids and plunged over falls. Their path took them across flat stretches where the sparks flew from the horse's hooves. Sultan ran with confidence and ease among the writhing roots of pine trees where the road passed through thick forest. There was a soft gurgling and rushing sound as he raced across small green plains where a meandering rivulet from the mountains streamed across. By daybreak he would be home, and that would be a fitting hour. The whole time Erland was doubtless thinking about that moon-blue wintry night long ago when he drove a sleigh down through this very valley. Bjorn Gunnarsson sat in back, holding a dead woman in his arms. But the memory was pale and distant, just as everything the child had told him seemed distant and unreal. All that had happened down in the village and those mad rumors about Kristen. Somehow his mind refused to grasp it. After he arrived, there would surely be time enough to think about what he should do. Nothing seemed real except the feeling of strain and fear. Now that he would soon see Kristen. He had waited and waited for her. He had never doubted that one day she would come to him, up until he heard what name she had given the child. Stepping out of the church into the gray light were those people who had been to early mass to hear one of the priests from Hamar preach. The ones who emerged first saw Erland Nikolausen ride past toward home, and they told the others. Some uneasiness and a great deal of talk arose. People headed down the slope and stood in groups at the place where the lane to Jurengard diverged from the main road. Erland rode into the courtyard as the waning moon sank behind the rim of clouds and the mountain ridge, pale in the dawn light. Outside the foreman's house stood a group of people, Jartrud's kinsmen and her friends who had stayed with her overnight. At the sound of horse hooves in the courtyard, the men who had been keeping guard in the room under the high loft came outside. Erland reined in his horse. He gazed down at the farmers and said in a loud, mocking voice, "Is there a feast being held on my estate and I knew nothing about it? Or why are you good folks gathered here at this early hour?" Angry, dark looks met him from all sides. Erland sat tall and slender astride the long-legged foreign stallion. Before, Sultan's mane had been clipped short, but now it was thick and uncut. The horse was ungroomed and had gray hairs on his head, but his eyes glittered dangerously, and he stomped and shifted uneasily, laying his ears back and tossing his small, elegant head so that flecks of lather sprinkled his neck and shoulders and the rider. The harness work had once been red, and the saddle inlaid with gold. Now they were worn and broken and mended. And the man was dressed almost like a beggar. His hair, which billowed from under a simple black woolen hat, was grayish-white. A gray stubble grew on his pale, furrowed face with a big nose. But he sat erect, and he was smiling arrogantly down at the crowd of farmers. He looked young, in spite of everything, and like a chieftain. Fierce hatred surged toward this outsider, who sat there, holding his head high and uncowed, after all the grief and shame and misery he had brought upon those whom these people considered their own chieftains. And yet the farmer who was the first to answer Erland spoke with restraint. "I see you have found your son, Erland, so I think you must know that we have not gathered here for any feast. And it seems strange you would jest about such a matter." Erland looked down at the child, who was still asleep. His voice grew more gentle. "The boy is ill. Surely you must see that. The news he brought me from here in the parish seemed so unbelievable that I thought he must be speaking in a feverish daze. And some of it is nonsense after all, I see." Erland frowned as he glanced at the stable door. Ulf Haldorsson and two other men, one of them his brother-in-law, were at that moment leading out several horses. Ulf let go of his horse and strode swiftly toward his master. "Have you finally come, Erland? And here's the boy. Praise be to Christ and the Virgin Mary. His mother doesn't know he was missing. We were about to go out to look for him. The bishop released me on my sworn oath when he heard the child had set off alone for Vaga. How is Lavrans?" he asked anxiously.
"Thank God you found the boy,"
said Jartrud, weeping. She had come out into the courtyard.
"Are you here, Jartrud?" said Erland. "That will be the first thing I see to, that you leave my estate, you and your cohorts. First we'll drive off this gossiping woman, and then anyone else who has spread lies about my wife will be fined."
"That cannot be done, Erland," said Ulf Haldorsson. "Jartrud is my lawful wife. I don't think either she or I has any desire to stay together, but she will not leave my house until I have placed in the hands of my brothers-in-law her livestock, dowry, betrothal gifts, and wedding gifts."
"Am I not the master of this estate?" asked Erland, furious.
"You will have to ask Kristin Lavran's daughter about that," said Ulf. "Here she comes."
The mistress was standing on the gallery of the new storeroom. Now she slowly came down the stairs. Without thinking, she pulled her wimple forward. It had slipped back off her head, and she smoothed her church gown, which she had worn since the day before. But her face was as motionless as stone. Erlund rode forward to meet her at a walking pace. Bending down a bit, he stared with fearful confusion at his wife's gray, dead face.
"Kristen," he implored, "my Kristen, I've come home to you."
She didn't seem to hear or see him. Then Lavrans, who was sitting in his father's arms and had gradually woken up, slid down to the ground. The moment his feet touched the grass, the boy collapsed and he lay in a heap. A tremor passed over his mother's face. She leaned down and lifted the big boy in her arms, pressing his head against her throat, as if he were a little child. But his long legs hung down limply in front of her.
"Kristen, my dearest love," begged Erlund in despair. "Oh, Kristen, I know I've come to you much too late."
Again a tremor passed over his wife's face.
"It's not too late,"
she said, her voice low and harsh. She stared down at her son, who lay in a swoon in her arms.
"Our last child is already in the ground, and now it's Lavron's turn. Gauta has been banished by the church, and our other sons. But the two of us still own much that can be ruined, Erlan."
She turned away from him and began walking across the courtyard with the child. Erlund rode after her, keeping his horse at her side.
"Kristen, Jesus, what can I do for you? Kristen, don't you want me to stay with you now?"
"I don't need you to do anything more for me," said his wife in the same tone of voice.
"You cannot help me, whether you stay here or you throw yourself into the log."
Erlund's sons had come out onto the gallery of the high loft. Now Gauta ran down and raced toward his mother, trying to stop her.
"Mother,"
he begged. Then she gave him a look, and he halted in bewilderment. Several farmers were standing at the bottom of the loft stairs.
"Move aside, men,"
said the mistress, trying to pass them with her burden. Sultan tossed his head and danced uneasily. Erlan turned the horse halfway around, and Kolbein Jonsson grabbed the bridle. Kristen hadn't seen what was happening. Now she turned to look over her shoulder.
"Let go of the horse, Kolbein. If he wants to ride off, then let him."
Kolbein took a firmer grip and replied,
"Don't you see, Kristen, that it's time for the master to stay home on his estate? You at least should realize it," he said to Erlund.
But Erlund struck the man over the hand and urged the stallion forward, so the old man fell. A couple of other men leaped forward. Erlund shouted,
"Get away from here! You have nothing to do with matters concerning me or my wife, and I'm not the master. I refuse to bind myself to a manor like a calf to the stall. I may not own this estate, but neither does this estate own me."
Kristen turned to face her husband and screamed,
"Go ahead and ride off. Ride, ride like the devil to hell. That's where you've driven me and cast off everything you've ever owned or been given."
What occurred next happened so fast that no one properly foresaw it or could prevent it. Tora Borghildsson and another man grabbed her by the arms.
"Kristen, you mustn't speak that way to your husband."
Erlund rode up close to them.
"Do you dare to lay hands on my wife?"
He swung his axe and struck at Tora Borghildsson. The blow fell between his shoulder blades, and the man sank to the ground. Erlund lifted his axe again, but as he raised up in the stirrups, a man ran a spear through him, and it pierced his groin. It was the son of Tora Borghildsson who did this. Sultan reared up and kicked with his front hooves. Erlund pressed his knees against the animal's sides and leaned forward as he pulled on the reins with his left hand and again raised his axe. But almost at once he lost one of his stirrups, and the blood gushed down over his left thigh. Several arrows and spears whistled across the courtyard. Ulf and Erlund's sons rushed into the throng with axes raised and swords drawn. Then a man stabbed the stallion Erlund was riding, and the animal fell to his knees, whinnying so wildly and shrilly that the horses in the stable replied. Erlund stood up, his legs straddling the animal. He put his hand on Björgulf's shoulder and stepped off. Gauta came up and grabbed his father under the other arm.
"Kill him,"
he said, meaning the horse,
which had now rolled onto his side and lay with his neck stretched out, blood frothing around his jaw, and his mighty hooves flailing. Ulf Haldorsson complied. The farmers had retreated. Two men carried Tora Borghildsson over to the foreman's house, and one of the bishop's men led away his companion, who was wounded. Kristin had put Lavrans down, since he had now regained his wits. They stood there, clinging to each other. She didn't seem to understand what had taken place. It had all happened so fast. Her sons began helping their father toward the high loft house, but Erlan said,
"I don't want to go in there. I don't want to die where Lavrans died."
Kristin ran forward and threw her arms around her husband's neck. Her frozen face shattered, contorted with sobs, the way ice is splintered when struck by a stone.
"Erlan, Erlan."
Erlund bent his head down so his cheek touched hers, and he stood in that manner for a moment.
"Help me up into the old storeroom, boys," he said. "I want to lie down there."
Hastily, Kristin and her sons made up the bed in the old loft and helped Erlund undress. Kristin bandaged his wounds. The blood was gushing in spurts from the gash of the spear in his groin, and he had an arrow wound on the lower left side of his chest, but it was not bleeding much. Erlund stroked his wife's head.
"I'm afraid you won't be able to heal me, my Kristin."
She looked up, despairing. A great shudder passed through her body. She remembered that Simon had said the same thing, and this seemed to her the worst omen, that Erlund should speak the same words. He lay in bed, supported with pillows and cushions, and with his left leg raised to stop the blood flowing from his groin wound. Kristin sat leaning over him. Then he took her hand.
"Do you remember the first night we slept together in this bed, my sweet? I didn't know then that you were already carrying a secret sorrow for which I was to blame. And that was not the first sorrow you had to bear for my sake, Kristin."
She held his hand in both of hers. His skin was cracked, with dirt ingrained around his small, grooved fingernails and in the creases of every joint of his long fingers. Kristin lifted his hand to her breast and then to her lips. Her tears streamed over it.
"Your lips are so hot," said Erlan softly. "I waited and waited for you. I longed so terribly. Finally, I thought I should give in. I should come down here to you. But then I heard. I thought, when I heard that he had died, that now it would be too late for me to come to you."
Sobbing, Kristin replied,
"I was still waiting for you, Erlan. I thought that someday you would have to come to the boy's grave."
"But then, you would not have welcomed me as your friend," said Erlan, "and God knows you had no reason to do so either. As sweet and lovely as you are, my Kristin," he whispered, closing his eyes.
She sobbed quietly, in great distress.
"Now nothing remains,"
said her husband in the same tone as before,
"except for us to try to forgive each other, as a Christian husband and wife, if you can."
"Erlan, Erlan."
She leaned over him and kissed his white face.
"You shouldn't talk so much, my Erlan."
"I think I must make haste to say what I have to say,"
replied her husband.
"Where is Nokva?"
he asked uneasily. He was told that the night before, as soon as Nokva heard that his younger brother was headed for Sunbu, he had set off after him as fast as his horse would go. He must be quite distraught by now, since he hadn't found the child. Erlan sighed, his hands fumbling restlessly on the coverlet. His six sons stepped up to the bed.
"No, I haven't handled things well for you, my sons," said their father.
He began to cough, in a strange and cautious manner. Bloody froth seeped out of his lips. Kristin wiped it away with her wimple. Erlund lay quietly for a moment.
"Now you must forgive me, if you can. Never forget, my fine boys, that your mother has striven on your behalf every day, during all the years that she and I have lived together. Never has there been any enmity between us,
except that for which I was to blame, because I paid too little mind to your well-being. But she has loved you more than her own life.
We won't forget, replied Gauta, weeping, that you, father, seem to us all our days the most courageous of men and the noblest of chiefs.